I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. High school seniors have a lot on their minds: getting a diploma, dancing at prom, preparing for the real world. You know, the usual. But how many of them develop technology to help fight a neurological disease? Today, meet the Lenexa high schooler who's doing just that. Find out how this young wunderkind is developing an app that detects early symptoms of Parkinson's. Then we talk with the musician who played with the Steve Miller Band before going on to record 20 albums of his own. We get the lowdown from singer-songwriter Boz Skaggs. After that, a live edition of Statehouse Blend. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. What if I told you that a Kansas City area resident is developing an app that helps detect the early signs of Parkinson's disease? And what if I told you this resident has traveled to the headquarters of Google and Twitter and won $10,000 to continue her research? And then, what if I told you that this resident is named Erin Smith and she happens to be a 17-year-old upcoming senior at Shawnee Mission West High School? Smith lives in Lenexa and she has quite a story to tell about her face print app and how it measures how muscles in the face move and how that may be an early detector of Parkinson's. And Erin Smith, welcome. So good to have you here and up to date.
Thank you.
How can you be 17 years old and doing important work like this? Help me with this. You're 17, Erin.
Well, this is just a project that I am super fascinated with. So I feel like some people go home and they work on homework and then maybe they watch TV or something. But over this past year, this project has just really engaged my interest so much that it's become a really big part of my life.
And you're saying it's more important than TV?
On occasion.
On occasion? I should probably check your driver's license to make sure you're really 17 years old. Is there a connection with Parkinson's in your family? Is that what drew your interest here?
Yeah. So when I first had the idea about a year and a half ago, it started as solely a scientific endeavor. So I was watching a video by the Michael J. Fox Foundation, and I noticed that whenever Michael J. Fox or another Parkinson's patient would laugh or smile, it came off as really emotionally distant or unfelt. And then as I talked to local caretakers and clinicians, they reported similar observations in their loved ones years before diagnosis. And then I also started reading through past research papers, and I found that the part of the brain that Parkinson's subjects experience changes in about 5 to 10 years before current diagnosis is the same section of the brain responsible for spontaneous facial expression formation.
So you began putting things together here, it sounds like, at age 17.
Yeah. So it was just kind of all these different pieces that came together to formulate this idea. And then ultimately, as I started working with local Parkinson's patients, it was really that human element and those human interactions that propelled it forward to where it is today.
Okay, so you notice that Parkinson's sufferers, their facial features, they differ in how they respond emotionally to different things. So how did you take that idea and then develop this app? How did you make that connection?
Yeah, so what I wanted to do was, after I had these observations and I had kind of the scientific foundation for it with the various pieces of this puzzle that I had found, I wanted to develop a way to really simplistically and remotely collect their spontaneous and posed facial expressions. And so I was trying to come up...
So you want to watch people's faces to see if, in fact, they might be suffering from Parkinson's or are going to suffer from Parkinson's.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And so I was trying to come up with some way that I could easily do this online, and I instantly thought of Super Bowl commercials because I know that in my family, that's my favorite part of the Super Bowl is watching the different commercials, and they always, like, they're specifically designed to make people laugh or make people smile. And so what I did was, in order to collect their spontaneous or their more like subconscious facial movements, I had them watch 5 Super Bowl commercials that I specifically selected to elicit certain facial expressions. And then in order to collect their posed facial expressions or their facial muscle movements that they were deliberately trying to make, I thought of selfies. So I chose 3 universal emojis, and they replicated those emojis while their picture was taken by their computer webcam.
And so what were you trying to tell from these photographs that you would take then as they watched the commercials or anything else or the selfies?
Yeah. So essentially what I was looking for then was there's something known as a facial action coding system, which essentially—
The facial action coding system. How do you know about these things?
Okay, so when I was in fourth grade, I used to watch a TV show with my family called Lie to Me, which is this detective crime show, and it is based off the professor that developed the facial action coding system, and he would use it to determine whether or not people were lying. So then a year and a half ago when I watched the Michael J. Fox Foundation video, my mind instantly went back to that TV show called Lie to Me, and I wondered if the facial action coding system could have healthcare implications.
So something in fourth grade gave you this idea for a way to detect early onset of Parkinson's.
Yes, yeah.
That's amazing. Okay, and so what does this early facial recognition thing, what does that tell you? What does that do?
Yeah, so essentially what it does is I look at 33 different tracker points on the face, and they're associated with distinct facial muscle movements, and then I determine which of these individual muscle movements are different in Parkinson's patients and what interactions are different.
And from that, you can tell if someone might be an early sufferer of Parkinson's.
Yes, so I discover the differences, and then I've built machine learning algorithms to use those differences to determine whether or not.
So in other words, someone can get in front of a camera on their computer, and they can watch these commercials as they're filming themselves. Then they send that film off or that tape off to you or somewhere, and you can run it through your algorithms and figure out if they in fact suffer from Parkinson's or not.
Yes. Yeah.
That's amazing. Yeah. And can anyone take this test?
Yes. Yeah. So right now it's all developed on a website. And so right now the process is all on this website that anybody can go to if they have access to the link. And then the results and algorithms aren't publicly available yet just because I'm working on improving those accuracies.
Mm-hmm. So you're improving them. And how accurate do you think this can be?
So right now my highest accuracy is about 88%, which is comparable to current diagnostic methods. And so what I'm doing right now is I'm collecting more responses, and I'm launching longitudinal studies, which will really help develop and refine because we're already seeing such high accuracy in such little time.
Yeah, I know you're just 17 and I'm 59, but what's a longitudinal study? What is that?
Yeah, so essentially what that means is that this summer I'll be launching studies where I will be monitoring different Parkinson's patients over the course of the next year, over the course of the next 5 years, to really track and pinpoint exactly when these differences are manifested in Parkinson's patients, and then to get diagnosis to that point, and then also to ensure that my diagnostic algorithms can continue to capture not only for diagnosis but also for monitoring.
So would you hope to increase your accuracy rate from 88% somewhere up into the 90s?
Yes, absolutely.
And that would make that far better than what current diagnostic actions are right now then, right?
Yes, yeah.
Okay. Let's go to a phone call here. Let's go to Paul from Kansas City. Paul, good morning. We're talking about Parkinson's with Aaron Smith. Good morning.
Good morning. First of all, thank you, Aaron. You are taking an initiative at a young age, already specified, where as some of the students in the major universities are trying to put in 4 to 8 years of education. So you are on top of it. My question is for you, this application you've developed for Parkinson's, how do you think that could be evolved into other physiological health dilemmas that we are facing now, for example, cancer, if we're lucky.
Are there other applications for what you've come up with here?
Yeah, absolutely. So something that I'm researching a lot right now is a lot of other neurological and other neurodegenerative disorders that have pathology or differences that occur in the two substrates of the brain responsible for spontaneous and posed facial expressions. And so essentially—
You're using a lot of really big words, and that's just amazing. I'm just trying to hang on here. I'm hanging on for dear life here, and you're doing great. Yeah. But you just know these things. It's very impressive.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So what I'm doing for these other diseases is essentially if they experience changes in certain parts of the brain, then there should be external manifestations of those changes which are visible from their facial expressions. So there's a lot of other diseases that you can kind of subjectively tell right now that they do in fact experience differences. And so I'm focusing on also quantifying those differences for the other diseases.
So potentially if someone develops cancer, let's say prostate cancer, might that show up on a facial feature at some point? Is that possible?
Something like prostate cancer.
Or is that different?
That may be different.
Okay.
And obviously that's something that we don't know yet and healthcare has never looked at before. But I believe that there will be more significant differences with more of neurological diseases.
Or like lung cancer. Maybe that might be something that would show up on a face?
Yeah, it all has to do with what parts of the brain are undergoing changes.
Ah, okay. Or brain cancer might be more direct.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay. Paul, I appreciate it. Anything else you wanted to ask, Garen?
Yes. So as far as the brain, narcolepsy might be more in the form of what you'll be doing with this application. It's a evolution in the near future, correct?
Yes.
As compared to cancer.
Yeah, absolutely. So like narcolepsy, I'm looking at PTSD, supranuclear palsy, and then also there's a lot of Parkinsonism diseases and disorders that I'm also looking at.
Thank you so much. I love this show. And thank you again,
Paul,
for your initiative.
You bet.
Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. You've patented all this.
Yes.
How did you know to do that, and who's helping you with that?
Yeah. So that last summer, so I started this research. I've been doing science fair competitions at the Greater Kansas City Science and Engineering Fair since fourth grade. And then I've been competing at like a national and international level. So last year, this project started as a science fair project. And so I started going to these competitions. And then people started coming up to me and asked me if I had a patent, asking me luckily in the local area, if I had started working on the intellectual property side of my idea. Mm. And all that was completely new territory to me. And I had no idea that I needed that, or if so, how to progress in that way. And so I luckily went to a patent program thing at the Kauffman Center, and I met somebody named Sally Williams from the UMKC Small Business and Technology Development Center, and she helped connect me with Justin Poplin from Lathrop & Gage, who has been amazing throughout this whole process, and his pro bono support has really made the patent side and the intellectual property side of my idea possible.
Is anyone else around the country doing what you're doing?
No. So right now I'm the only one doing this with Parkinson's disease. In the past year, there's been a few other diseases where this process has kind of started to gain ground, but it's been really amazing that I was able to have this idea a year and a half ago and get the intellectual property groundwork laid.
Huh. What are your goals for Faceprint down the road, Erin? As you look down the road 5, 10, 15 years, what do you see happening here?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think there's kind of three main pathways of development. So the first is to continue to develop and refine the Parkinson's diagnostic model and app. And so that, as we talked about a few minutes ago, is launching longitudinal studies, really continuing to collect data and to refine and perfect my diagnostic algorithms. And then the second use case would be replicating this process for other neurological and other neurodegenerative disorders, such as PTSD or supranuclear palsy. And then the third use case is that the facial recognition software I use is compatible with that used by companies such as Facebook and Snapchat. So essentially, once I have discovered the biomarkers and created the diagnostic algorithms for Parkinson's and the other diseases, we can essentially use that, and it will be compatible with social media tools, which would be really amazing to turn Facebook or ultimately Snapchat into some sort of healthcare screening diagnostic tool.
How will early diagnosis of Parkinson's help the patient?
Yeah. So something that's really difficult right now with Parkinson's disease is that there's really limited effective therapeutics. And for example, L-DOPA is what's commonly used by most patients. And so what we can...
Is that a pill, a prescription you take?
Yeah. It's basically artificially replicates the process of dopamine being produced. But essentially, if we can limit this kind of early critical time period where they're starting to experience symptoms, mm-hmm. but they're not diagnosed yet. If we can kind of tap into this critical time period, then we'll be able to test and develop novel therapeutics. And then there's also been a few therapeutics that are developed that are proven to be most effective when introduced early on.
So getting in there early might be really helpful to these people.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. We have a question here from Lee, who wrote in to ask, what about including MS in the study in the future? Multiple sclerosis.
Yes.
Sclerosis. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's actually another disease that I've been researching and trying to really narrow down which disease I'm going to focus on next or which subset of diseases.
You know, you've had to make all these presentations. I'm thinking you've spoken, you've traveled to Google and Twitter's headquarters. You've talked in front of a lot of really smart people. Is that hard for you?
Oh my gosh, I still get nervous every time before I get interviewed.
But you're smiling when you're saying it, though.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Is it hard being here today?
I mean, I'm definitely still nervous, but I love it. It's been amazing to get to meet so many amazing people and to travel across the United States. It's been a really amazing experience.
But what makes you the most nervous?
Oh boy. Talking to clinicians still really makes me nervous.
But you sound like you really have learned their language and what they're talking about.
Yes, it's definitely
like you're talking above my pay grade, and which isn't very high, but you're up there. It's good. It's cool. Yeah. What do your friends in school say about all this? Do they have a hard time relating to this?
I definitely talk about it, but there's me at school, and then there's me when I'm in my basement coding this. So I definitely have a normal teenage life.
Yeah, but you don't talk to your friends a whole lot about this stuff.
No.
Yeah, because why?
That's a good question. Just to ensure that I can still be relatable in the sense that we're still going to high school together, and just to keep them as my friends.
Because you're in a whole different orbit than where their lives are right now.
I think it might frighten people a little bit if I...
Do you intimidate your own teachers?
I hope not. I don't think so. I have amazing teachers who have really helped me throughout this process too.
Yeah. You know, you founded an organization called the KC Steminis.
Yes.
What are the primary goals of this organization and what motivated you to start it here?
Yeah, so KC Steminis was something I started last year with a few of my friends. And so what it is, it's essentially a program designed to teach middle and high school girls how to code. And so when I first had this idea for the project about a year and a half ago, so I had this idea, but I'd actually never coded before. And so that was a really intimidating thing for me to have this idea. I couldn't stop thinking about it. I knew that I had to make this like a tangible reality, but I didn't know how. And so essentially my own story, I got a lot of coding from dummy books from the library, and I locked myself in my basement and taught myself how to code. And there was a lot of mentors that I was able to email or reach out to that really helped me along the way. But I want to take what I've learn from my experience and make it easier for other girls to learn how to code. And so I designed a class with a few of my friends who are also really involved in coding to help teach the fundamentals to middle and high school girls.
Is it working?
Yes. So we have our first program was last year from like December to March, and it was really amazing. By the end of the program, all the girls had developed an app idea in a small group, and they had really developed not only the skill set necessary to make technologies in the future, but also gained the confidence that this was something that they could do, something that they loved. It was more of an artistic, like, art form than purely science or math.
Do they join you in the basement sometimes and help?
We usually do it at JUCO.
At JUCO.
But, I mean, it sort of looks like a basement where
now,
we are.
Last thing, do some of your high school friends, do they give you a hard time sometimes about what you're doing? Like, oh, you're this scientist kid or something, or do you get some grief from them?
Yeah, definitely. People always come up to me and they're like, oh my gosh, you're going to be like the person that cures cancer. And it's kind of like, wait, Parkinson's, cancer. There's kind of a stretch between the two.
Well, most kids don't know what the difference between the two is, probably, right?
Probably.
Probably, yeah. Well, Erin, you are just remarkable. What a pleasure to meet you. Erin Smith, she's going to be a senior at Shawnee Mission West High School working on this app that will help us find early onset of Parkinson's disease. I wish you all the best, and come back and see us when you've made more progress, because I'd really like to keep up with you.
Perfect. Thank you.
Okay. That's Erin Smith. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll be joined by Boz Skaggs. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, we learned about Robert Kennedy's political transformation following his brother's assassination. Also, we talked about dark money in Missouri politics. You can listen to those conversations at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, we ask, why can't KC solve its violent crime problem? And we want to hear from you, too. So be sure to tune in tomorrow and call in to share your perspective on dealing with KC's ongoing violent crime issues. Boz Skaggs knows what it's like to be on top of the music world. He was there with his 1976 release, Silk Degrees, that contained this hit, Lido Shuffle. And for the record, this was the soundtrack to my freshman year at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where Skaggs once attended with a guy named Steve Miller. That monster success was preceded by tougher times, including a failed debut album and another that earned critical praise, but not so much in sales. For a while in the 1980s, Skaggs left his music career behind and opted to open a San Francisco nightclub. But by the late 80s, he was back making records, and he hasn't stopped since. Boz Skaggs will be in town this weekend, and he joins us right now from San Antonio. And Boz, what a pleasure. Good morning.
Good morning, Steve. Nice to be with you.
You made six albums before Silk Degrees came out in 1976. Critics liked them, but you didn't sell a whole lot of albums. I'm wondering, how worried were you that maybe this music thing wasn't going to work out for you?
Well, while it's true, there were six albums, or maybe seven. There's one that that I made in Europe that never was released here. But, in those days, there were album sales were quite large, and by comparison, I was selling 200,000 and 300,000 records, each of those early records, which were, you know, still pretty respectable enough to keep Columbia Records interested, and rather interested, and believing in me. And obviously, when Silk Degrees hit big, it was the payoff for a lot of work on my part and the record company's part. So it was, a nice and very timely surprise when it happened, but there was a lot leading up to it, as you infer.
When you recorded Silk Degrees, did you think you had something special there?
You know, I think that everyone who gets into this occupation, this game, believes in what they do, believes in themselves and what they're trying to do to some degree. And when you get to make your first record and you write your first songs and you go on the road and you're out there doing this thing, you believe in what you're doing. You believe in yourself. And when you have the opportunity to make a record at that time, a major label was a rare and sort of special opportunity. And you give it your best, and at some point in the process, you come to really very much believe that you're doing something that's very meaningful and going to be meaningful for you know, a lot of people, your fans and perhaps some new fans. And you have hopes, you have dreams, and it's not unusual that you don't really set the world on fire as you had imagined as, mm-hmm. as a young kid. And after, when it comes to, you know, the second record, maybe it too doesn't really reach the heights of the wide audience that you'd expected or wanted. You carry your hopes and dreams still, and then after two or three or four releases, you become a little more realistic and really just concentrate on what it's all about, mm-hmm. which is just doing what you do. You perfect your style. You work on your if you're a musician, you work on your instrument, your voice, your songwriting capabilities, and you just build it up, build and build, and then when it comes, if it comes, it fortunately did for me in the form of that Silk Degrees record that you mentioned.
Yeah,
it makes it all worthwhile, and you sort of know what to do with that so-called success. You learn to use it to further your career, and it's not a heady ego storm like it might have been if it were that first record.
Boz Skaggs is my guest, but Boz, Silk Degrees was something extraordinary. I read it sold not only millions, it was quintuple platinum. What's it like to be on top of the pop world when something hits like that one hits? That's just extraordinary.
Well, several factors played. If it had been my first record, I think it would have been, pretty crazy, but it wasn't. And this record was a slow build, like records that I'd done before. It was not an instant hit. Hmm. It was on the Billboard album charts for several years, and it didn't come on with any blockbuster, and we put out a couple of singles that did not hit big. It was just that, I think it was like the third or fourth single, which was, we did Lido and Lowdown,
yeah,
became a hit and won a Grammy, and that just lit the fire across the board, and it grew and it grew. In the meantime, I was on the road, and as I had been for, you know, 5 or 6 years before that, I just kept working. And so it wasn't like you wake up one morning and you won the lottery or anything. It's more like you work day after day, night after night, down the road, and then you get the messages from management and from the record company to say, man, this looks really good. We just got another city. We just got on another radio station with the latest. You know, it's a process. So it was a slow build, and it was the beginning of sort of a storm. You know, once you hit that sort of that kind of jackpot, your stock goes up. And
I'd say
while it was the same, I was still doing what I did. I was just playing larger venues, and I was able to buy, you know, a nicer way of transportation around and take care of the band a little better.
You're so low-key about it, Boz.
Well, that's the way it goes.
Yeah.
That's the truth. And you realize that after, when it hits, it's not a big glamorous affair. It's work, and it has its own demands, and it started a chain reaction.
Well, it's one thing to sell a lot of albums. It's another to make music that's widely respected. This album struck critics as this perfect blend of influences, R&B, New Orleans, blues, soul. Let's listen to one example of that. Boz just referred to it. This song is Lowdown.
How much you done spent? I swear she must believe it's all hell to see. Hey boy, you better bring a check around. To the sad, sad truth, the dirty low down.
still like that album, Boz?
I do. I still play some of that material regularly, and it wears pretty well.
Yeah. So. You gave up.
Not to be. I mean, not to be egotistical about it, but it was well recorded with great musicians, and
yeah.
Some songs last and hang in there and have some legs, and some don't. But I'm proud of it.
Yeah, you gave up recording music and touring for much of the 1980s, just a few years later after Silk Degrees came out, and instead you mm-hmm. ran a San Francisco nightclub called Slim's. Why did you go there?
Well, I'd like to be a little more accurate about that.
Okay.
Slim's didn't open till the late 80s after I had come back to my record company and recorded another album. I really took that time off because I had two young children and had been on the road constantly for the better part of 10 years, and I decided to take 6 months off. After a world, this was 1980, I did a world tour, released the greatest hits album, plus a new album. And I did a world tour and decided to take some time off and be with my family. And that 6 months turned into 7 months and 8 months and a year, and it went on. I just really got away from the high pressure and the profession. There was no music in me at the time. I felt kind of drained, and I just took the time away. Fortunately, I was able to afford to get away for a while and be with my family, and my personal life took over.
And when you came back, I was really...
I didn't really stop to open a club to be
okay.
I did. My brothers and I opened a little bar restaurant in San Francisco, and I played some golf and played with my kids for a few years.
Hmm. When you did come back, the president of your recording company, CBS, told you one day that he didn't hear any hits in the album you were making at the time. It was called Other Roads. How did that go down with you?
Well, it was a shock. I'd never had any real authority in a record company, making judgments about what was a hit or what was what was not a hit, and that was not my idea of what it was about to make a record or to make music at all. And I'd never heard that before. But then, the 80s were a changing time. In the record business, in the music business. And that's the way things were done. It became much more business and marketing oriented or at least took a different form than I was used to. So I complied with the company. I went in and cut another three or four songs and submitted them and said, well, that's it. You can do what you like with it, but I'm under contract.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, it didn't sit well. It was a president. It was a fellow who I'd never met before. I knew the regime of the record company that I'd been with before and had a close relationship with the people in the company. I enjoyed my contact with them, and they did a lot for me, and I worked hard for them to do what our mutual goal was. But this other guy was new to me, and he had a strange way of...
Yeah.
Marketing. I never liked him very much.
What do you make of where the industry is today, Boz? With its Spotify's and digital downloads and Apple Music, is it as bad for the artists as we're being told that it is?
I would say, yeah, in many ways. They keep talking about the music business is coming back and sales are going to be what they were, and but that's like talking about. That boat left the port a long time ago, that old model of the music business. And yes, there is a music business out there now, but it bears little or no resemblance to what went on in the past, with actual, sales of CDs or tangible objects. That's gone. Records, cassettes, CDs, etc. And now it's digital sales. And unfortunately, musicians and writers aren't able to participate in that, and it's not the same to have a career now as a performer or a composer or a creator as it used to be. Now it's just sheer huge numbers of digits that are flying around,
and yeah.
The music itself is wonderful, I must say. There's so much variety and so much talent and so many interesting ways of presenting individual artistic music out there. It's a brilliant time, but it's not a great time for somebody who wants to make a career of it, because
yeah.
It's fleeting and it doesn't pay.
Boss Gags and Michael McDonald will be performing at 7:30 Saturday night at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts here in Kansas City. Tickets and more information, kauffmancenter.org. Let's fast forward, Boss, to your latest project, because it's good. The album is called A Fool to Care. Let's listen to a little bit of it, because this is vintage Boss Gags.
I got a woman with plenty of money. She got the money and I got the honey. Called my baby late last night. She told me, Daddy, everything was all right.
That's Boss Gags from his new album, A Fool to Care. The track is Rich Woman. And, Boss, you got Lucinda Williams and Bonnie Raitt to join you on this. And I got to ask, did you guys record face-to-face, or is it all done digitally now?
No, that was very live and very much face-to-face. That's real live excitement going on.
How fun was that with those two?
That's about as good as it gets. Bonnie came up to my house, and we spent a day playing guitars and singing and kind of restructuring. And then with Lucinda, we were face-to-face in the studio, and both are rare and fine. Listen, I've got to jump off.
All right, Boz.
I appreciate
the time very much. Boss Gags will be here with Michael McDonald 7:30 Saturday night at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. Tickets and more information, kauffmancenter.org. Missouri's General Assembly is back in session again. Their second special session was gaveled in yesterday. Governor Eric Reitens is calling this one to address various issues relating to abortion. Today we're having our own live special session of KCUR's political podcast, State House Blend Missouri. Host Brian Ellison is here to talk about Reitens' special session and what it means for policy and politics in the state. And Brian, always good to have you here.
Steve, good to see you.
How does a special session usually work, Brian? What's this all about?
Well, okay, as you know, usually the governor, when there is something extraordinary, some unusual circumstance, maybe something that's very time sensitive, the governor can call both the House and the Senate back into session, gives a very explicit call, says this is the issue you're here to talk about. They have to stay within that subject matter, and then they act or they don't. They have 60 days to do it. Of course, we know this because just 3 weeks ago, the governor called a special session around a particular steel mill and aluminum smelter that wanted to create some economic incentives for. That session lasted about a week. The House and the Senate passed a bill. it was done, it was over with, and presumably now they're on to trying to bring that that business to Missouri.
You know, typically you think of special sessions and you think of extraordinary needs, something's really pressing that needs to get done right away. What qualifies in this special session when it comes to abortion?
Well, that of course depends on who you ask. So we asked the governor that question. KCUR's Dan Margulies went out to the bill signing that the governor had for the Real ID bill yesterday out at Whiteman Air Force Base and asked why this had to be a special session. What was so urgent about it? And here's what the governor told Dan.
You know, unfortunately, we had some radical politicians in St. Louis, Missouri, that wanted to create an abortion sanctuary city, where it would have made it illegal for pregnancy care centers and other pro-life organizations just to hire pro-life workers. This is really important work that we get done, and I'm proud to stand up and protect our pregnancy care centers, which do incredible work on behalf of pregnant women and their newborn children all over the state of Missouri.
So, Steve, what the governor's talking about there is an ordinance passed by the St. Louis Board of Aldermen back in February that prohibited discrimination on the basis of women's reproductive health choices. And as that act has been portrayed, and some would say that was a largely symbolic act anyway, but as it's been portrayed, it would affect the so-called crisis pregnancy centers or alternative to abortion agencies. That's what the governor's talking about. Forcing them to hire people who did not share their anti-abortion views. In the name of defending those kinds of organizations, the governor said something needed to be done to override, to essentially repeal that St. Louis ordinance. So that's half of what this session's about.
You know, I'm wondering how lawmakers feel about having to go back again. A lot of these lawmakers have jobs, they have careers, they have families. They've just spent 4 or 5 months in Jefferson City doing the people's business, and now the governor's called them back not once but twice. He's threatening to bring them back maybe 3 or 4 or 5 times before the next session begins. How happy or unhappy are these lawmakers? What are you hearing around the state?
Yeah, well, in a word, they're not very happy. I can summarize
really?
It that way. Now, there are exceptions. So you hear like some of the strongest anti-abortion voices in the Senate, so people like Senator Bob Onder, who is the sponsor of the Senate Bill 1, which will be the main piece of legislation that's considered in this session. He agrees this is extraordinary. This is urgent and is happy to be back to address it since it didn't get addressed in the regular session. On the other hand, you hear a lot of other legislators, including Republicans as well as Democrats, who are not so thrilled with the governor. You heard folks like, take Jason Holzman, the Democratic senator from Kansas City. He actually filed a resolution yesterday proposing a year-round legislative session, saying apparently the governor can't get the job done during the session as it's currently scheduled. So let's go ahead and just call it what it is. It's a year-round legislature.
Well, mind that if we're going to do repeated special sessions, that maybe we're at a point where we need a full-time legislature and not the part-time situation we have now.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's ironic, isn't it? Because the governor has made a point of attacking the legislators, calling them, quote, corrupt career politicians. But in fact, they aren't career politicians. For the most part, they all have other jobs. It is a part-time citizen legislature in Missouri.
Yeah.
The only one who has a full-time job among them is the governor. And yet, he keeps calling them back, and some of them just aren't happy about it.
We're talking about Missouri's special legislative session that Governor Eric Greitens just called. It began yesterday. You know, there's a lot of political overtones here, Brian, as to what the governor is all about here. One of the suspicions on the far right's side during the campaign last year was that he wasn't conservative enough. They didn't really know where he stood on abortion. Some critics are saying what this special session is all about is Governor Greitens shoring up the far right wing of his Republican base and making sure everyone knows that he's as anti-choice as they come here.
Yeah, and I think, Steve, there's some good reason to think that that if he is successful in this session at passing this legislation, that he will in fact shore up his credentials on the right. I mean, the legislation that's coming out doesn't just address that St. Louis ordinance; it also responds to the federal court ruling that struck down a lot of Missouri's regulations that were limiting the number of abortion clinics operating in Missouri. Mm-hmm. Once Planned Parenthood came out and said they're going to open 3 or 4 additional clinics around the state that are providing abortion services. This legislation is being proposed that will provide all kinds of additional requirements, plans they have to have for complications, how they report on tissue disposal, giving the attorney general jurisdiction to enforce violations, not just the county level prosecutors. So these are serious additions to state abortion regulations, similar to those, some would say, that have been struck down by federal courts in other places, but it will certainly beef up the credentials of the governor as a pro-life advocate.
What do you expect is a likely outcome to this special session of the Missouri General Assembly? Where are we going here, do you think?
Well, I think just if you count in the votes, counting the noses, I think there are the votes to pass pretty strong anti-abortion legislation in Missouri. Now, what could happen, the alternative would be if the Senate, it probably would be the Senate, votes to adjourn, simply to say, we're not going to play along with this governor's special session game anymore.
As a way to get him to stop calling so many special sessions.
Right. And I think, you know, I think if it were a different issue, that very well might happen. You've heard some Republicans, Ryan Silvey of Kansas City is one of them, say that they would support that kind of motion. Having said that, Senator Silvey probably will vote for the anti-abortion legislation, and I think there certainly are the votes to support it in the Senate and the House. And so I don't know how long it'll take. I don't know what the final form will be, but I would expect that we'll have a new law at the end of this session.
So bottom line is it'd be tough for lawmakers to protest when it comes to abortion legislation. That issue still carries so much clout among many Republicans and Democrats across the state.
Right, which means that the governor will be successful, that this will be a gamble that pays off. But what does it cost him, Steve? I mean, I think you and I could talk about that, too. There's all kinds of adverse reactions. He's losing support bit by bit among his fellow Republicans, especially on the Senate side. There was a resolution filed yesterday calling for an investigation of Governor Greitens and of his so-called dark money pack. And so we'll see what happens. There will be a victory, perhaps, but there might also be a cost.
We talked about dark money on yesterday's Up to Date. Brian Ellison, host of State House Blend Missouri, thanks very much.
My pleasure, Steve.
You can find the podcast at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. It's also on the NPR One app. Tomorrow on the show, recent efforts in Kansas City to slow down rates of violent crime have had little impact. Tomorrow on the show, we'll ask why KC can't solve its crime problem. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Marlia Campbell. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are Up to Date.